Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Horowitz, and we have lots in store for you today. We're going to talk about some of the things post-New Year. We're going to have a discussion about the resolutions that you can be making for a profitable portfolio and a profitable future, because oftentimes, I don't know about you, but you make these resolutions, or I make these resolutions, and I really have all intent on sticking with them. But something happens about the first week or second week of the year, and all of a sudden those resolutions become kind of things of the past. You know, I always love going to, I love driving past the workout places and gyms, and it's amazing that the first week of the year, particularly the first couple of days, are so crowded, so busy. But what happens maybe a couple of days later, a week later, 2 weeks later? There's plenty of parking in the parking lot, isn't there? Well, this year, what I'm hoping to do is really lay down some ideas for you to have a good sense of not only resolutions, but commitments for your finances and portfolios so that you can have a successful year, because we ended on a bit of a rocky note last year, and we're probably going to continue to do so moving forward. And also today, we have an interview and a guest that I recently spoke with, Paul Kodrowski, who is an amazing blogger, financial wizard, and I'm going to ask him some things. I think he's going to help us understand about blogging, about what he's doing in the financial area, as well as what's happening with these markets, and really put some direction, because I've read his stuff for a while, and I think he's just marvelous. He does a blog called Infectious Greed. And that's all coming up today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So welcome aboard. Happy New Year. And sit back, because the Disciplined Investor Podcast is starting right now.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager.
Hi, this is Timothy Sykes of TimothySykes.com. I am also the author of An American Hedge Fund. You are listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
All right, so welcome back. And as I promised, we're going to first start off with some profitable resolutions for the new year. And the transcript of this is actually a post on the site that we put up a couple of days back. So take a look at that. If you want to print this, go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You know, I did this because it seems that, again, the commitment made to resolutions each year and each new year is such a common pastime in the United States. That did you know that the government actually has a webpage dedicated to what they call the top New Year's resolutions? According to the Government Made Easy website, which is at www.usa.gov, there are a dozen or so popular resolutions that we seem to revisit year after year. This year, we're going to think about something different. We're going to think about taking those same resolutions and applying them to your investments and finances. Here are a few of the ideas. I put down about 12 of them that will help disciplined investors, and that's you out there, keep your finances on track throughout 2008. First, lose weight. Put your investment portfolio on a diet. In other words, get rid of the fat and keep it off. Look carefully through the list of your investments. Wonder, ask, think about, do you have stragglers that are there just keeping them because, well, they've been there for years? There's no better way to clean up your portfolio and rebalance a portfolio than to get rid of the non-performing positions. And you know what? It's not easy. It's not easy for an individual. And I'll tell you, it's not easy for a professional either, because the question comes time and time again, what if that does move up? A great portfolio manager who used to run the Fidelity Magellan Fund, I was speaking with him at a conference, and I remember him saying something that I'll never forget. He said, every single day, he takes a look at his portfolio and realizes that there is a straggler in there somewhere. There's a dog in there somewhere. But the question is, where is it? That's what haunts him every day. And that's what you need to be doing, is really kind of condensing your portfolio and getting rid of the stocks, bonds, and mutual funds that don't meet the investment criteria and your investment objectives. Be critical and maybe even a bit brutal, and cut out the unnecessary load. And it's going to be a big help. Next on our list is paying off debt. Be careful not to overborrow. While margin can be utilized in a great way for good reason, it is not appropriate for most investors. Make sure that your portfolio accounts, your investment accounts, are free from the margin debt and commit to paying down any outstanding loans. closed positions that you've been bought on margin, that you use margin to borrow and buy with in your portfolio. And if you do not have, if you've been accessing this, really looking at margin as a way to really fund the rest of your life, you need to stop. Stop using the margin, which is actually a very high cost way of utilizing money for things outside of maybe short positions and options and possibly even short-term trading. But if you're holding margin for a long time, for whatever reason it is, it's not a good idea. Saving money is our next one. It is time to stop paying high commissions and fees. There is no reason that anyone should be paying the high costs associated with front or back-end loaded mutual funds. Of course, even with the no-load funds, the managers will take some type of fee, but be careful not to pay higher than average for within a fund in the same objective. Consider utilizing low-cost index funds and maybe even ETFs this year. Also, what I want you to do, I want you to talk with your stockbroker about reducing the fees associated with stock and bond trading. You know, today, there are several, I'll say reputable and maybe even very accessible, deep discount brokers that can offer substantial savings as a really good alternative to the high costs associated with traditional stockbrokers. So I think that you owe it to yourself to make sure that you're paying the least possible for the same service that you can get anywhere. Get a better job. Even, I guess, if you've been content with your current position, you can still look at the benefits that are offered by your employer. Question whether or not you're maximizing all of the plans that are offered and wonder, is your 401k receiving the maximum amount of annual contributions from all sources? Have the premiums that you pay for health insurance been shifted to a pre-tax basis? Many employees are allowed to actually take the monies that they pay on a monthly basis from a after-tax standpoint to a pre-tax standpoint through their employers. Go and ask your human resource department and the representatives for a personal meeting. Say, you know, I want to review my situation, my benefits, and make sure that I'm making the most out of them moving forward. All right. Now, we all think about getting fit. We think about exercising. But what about taking your portfolio out for a little breather, a little walk, a little chin-ups? You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, I will now review my financials more and more. That's going to be the chant and the strut. It's time to commit to reviewing your finances on a regular basis. Avoiding the statements and allowing for financial lethargy will get you absolutely nowhere really fast. Just like it's good for your body and exercise is, you know, really healthy for you, it's also good for your pocketbook. Think about spending maybe 1 or 2 hours a week reviewing your finances and making sure you understand where you stand. Why not? I mean, we look and measure all sorts of things and our progress, but how often do we really stop for a second and look at our finances? Review your statements, your confirms, and all of the mail related to your finances to ensure that your plan is on track each and every week. Make that commitment. Next, we have eating right. They say, eat a bagel, look like a bagel. The same is true somewhat with regard to your portfolio. We could say, buy lousy investments, have lousy investments. Start looking carefully at the ingredients and fundamentals that make up the companies that you are buying. Look at the ratios, the management, and just the overall health of the company before you decide to add it to your portfolio this year. Be careful not to just take advice that you've seen on TV or in podcasts or on blogs or on in the newspaper, on the radio. Do some research for yourself. Next resolution, get a better education. That's right. Commit to reading 3 investment books this year. I'm not going to twist your arm to read mine, but find some good investment books to read out there. Check out an online bookseller's bestseller list in the area of investing and money management. Or maybe even go to your local library and see what's getting good reviews. Ask some questions. Ask your friends. Find out, what are they reading? What are they like? You could also subscribe to a few featured iTunes business and investing podcasts and learn about areas of finance that you may not be familiar with. If you've been listening for a while, you know that on our site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, we have a list of what we call the BESPE Awards, the best blogs, podcast sites, and overall education that you can really utilize. Go to the site, check out that page, and you have links galore that you can use to give yourself a better education. Next up, drinking less alcohol. All right, maybe there's a loose fit to portfolios, but let's have a go at it. All too often, we become, I guess, intoxicated on our own successes, don't we? We tell stories about the profitable trades and forget about the losing ones in an attempt to show off our stock market prowess. Stop reveling in just the successful stories and begin to look at the bigger picture. While many of the discussions that we find and we listen to and we participate in on golf courses and even the shuffleboard courts are filled with the tales of recent stock winners, ask your buddies about the losers. Here's a twist. Ask your friends to tell you about one loser for every winner they brag about. Good luck with that one. How about quitting smoking? Red hot and smoking are adjectives that are usually there describing many stock tips that you'll hear about. Unfortunately, these often turn out to be big, ugly losers that eventually need to be sold for a deep and rather ugly loss. They're supposed to be helping you with your retirement, aren't they? Why are we going for these? Why? Because we love the action. We love the opportunity. Stay clear of any friendly advice that seems too good to be true. Ask yourself, why you in particular have been specially chosen to receive this amazing inside information? Then what you want to do is ponder how it is that this particular penny stock is going to be priced at $100 within a few weeks. The next time someone tells you this is going to be the next Google, politely tell them to off. All right, next. We have a couple more to go. Reducing stress overall. The high levels of stress that you feel when your portfolio is riding that market roller coaster is absolutely unnecessary. Reduce portfolio volatility by diversifying your investments and adding positions that can actually hedge the risk. Make sure that you have separate and distinct investment positions that cover the wide gamut of asset classes and industry sectors. If you're unsure if you've done a good job of this, well, you know what? Seek professional advice who can maybe, I don't know, help review your holdings. Next, we're going to reduce stress. We're going to absolutely take it down to a different level, reducing the stress at work. You know how you're going to do this? You're going to stop checking your positions every 20 minutes. Change the start page at your company's computer where you sit and change the browser where it goes, not to maybe the finance page, but to something outside of the world of finance. There is no reason that the average investor needs to continually check the values of their portfolio. Think about it. Let it stew for a while. Nothing is going to change by compulsively checking the portfolio values and your stock prices throughout the day. Next, and the final, is take a trip. Plan to visit your investment advisor, the person who you're working with, your accountant, your attorneys, all the people who are working on your financial plans, and commit to taking a good look at your portfolio. Review your tax plan, revisit and discuss your estate plan, and ask if there has been any changes within the tax and investment areas that may be of benefit. Be sure to ask about new tax initiatives, as well as strategies that may help to create additional efficiencies. Because if you haven't done so for a while, well, you're not going anywhere. I mean, simply, again, letting things sit and bake is just not really the whole way that a professional would do it, nor would an investor who's really committed to making money with their portfolio. Now, once you get those committed, there was a comment by Dr. Bernard Davidson, who is a family psychologist at the Medical College of Georgia Health System, who said that simple advice on how to keep your resolutions well beyond the first week of the year is simple. Number one, be committed. Number two, be prepared for setbacks. And number three, track your progress. Doesn't that make sense? I mean, we talked about all the different things. We're always committed to doing something on New Year's Eve that's going to help ourselves. Why not now, after maybe some of those have faded, recommit to our finances, recommit to our portfolios, and really make yourself, well, wealthy in the future by making yourself resolute to do so. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about maybe some of the things that are going to go on in the markets in the future. Get to that interview with Paul Kudrowski of Infectious Greed, the blogger who has just a wonderful following. I think you'll enjoy it. Beyond that, we're going to get on with this episode of The Disciplined Investor. So thanks for joining me and stick around. We'll be right back.
This is Kristen Bentz with TheStreet.com's Real Money, and you're listening to The Disciplined Investor podcast.
Looking for answers to today's complex financial markets? Then be sure to get your copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, your all-in-one guide to investing. Order now at thedisciplinedinvestor.com or your favorite bookstore. The Disciplined Investor. Together, we will reach success.
If you like what you hear, we want to know. Go to our show's listing on either iTunes or your favorite podcast directory and leave us feedback and a rating. The more feedback we have, the higher our position on the charts. Think of it as the price of admission. It only takes a minute and helps us understand more about what interests you. Keep our blog and podcast popular, and we'll keep providing you with great investment ideas.
All right, we're back on The Disciplined Investor. Thanks for joining me. By the way, if you haven't had the chance to get on with your purchasing of The Disciplined Investor, which is a book I wrote recently, remember, many of you have taken the opportunity to do so. If you buy it on Amazon.com, leave a review. Let me know. Send a comment, an email to reviews@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll send you a free link to get the audiobook of the book. So again, a lot of people, thank you, have taken the opportunity to do so. And if you'd like to do so as well, just go buy the book, leave a review, and just let me know. We'll send it off to you. So as promised, we're here with Dr. Paul Kodrowski, who is the writer of the wonderful blog Infectious Greed. And as you know, he is involved in a lot of things, involved in venture capital and a senior research advisor for 10 Asset Management. So thanks for coming on.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So here's a couple of things I want to ask you. So, you know, we know you won that one of the best blog awards for the world of finance because you are quite a writer. And I've always wanted to know, when I see people who are writing and blogging continually, where do you get all the ideas from? I mean, where's it come from, and where's all the stuff, you know, flow out of you from?
I'll use the PG version, but, you know, the world really, you know, irritates me a lot. And so when the world irritates me, rather than, you know, wandering off and harassing bus drivers, taxi drivers, flight attendants, and others, for me, it generally turns into blog posts.
Ah.
And almost anything that, that sort of crosses me and feels as if something that, you know, maybe it's bothering me or is something that I'm struggling with, I generally speaking, the best outlet for me is to turn it into a blog post. And as it turns out, there are a lot of things that bug me, so a lot of things turn into blog posts.
I guess the way that we get all great modern day inventions is from someone being totally frustrated about something and then doing something about it. So maybe you're going to solve some very significant world issue economically.
Well, you know, I take your point, and I put it somewhat similar way. Whenever I've got, you know, I wear a couple of hats here. Well, you know, obviously, this is the 10 Assets, a buy side firm, but. Whenever I'm doing my venture capital stuff, I think, you know, a lot of entrepreneurship comes from people scratching their own itch. And for me, you know, blog posts are really about scratching my own itch.
Yeah, I hear you. So let me ask you, you know, our economic climate is one that I find very bifurcated. You know, we have this amazing technology, which is big. You're big into technology, know a lot about that, and you write a lot about that. Mm-hmm. But we have this amazing technology boom that kind of, you know, really blossomed back in, you know, 2000, 1999, 1998, and before, and then just dropped off, then just launched again. And we have this other side of the economy that when you look at it, you're like, oh my, where are we going here? What's the main reason why we have this separation?
Separation on the technology front?
Well, technology from everything else. I mean, if you look at just stock prices compared to everything else, you wonder what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different things happening here. One is that for a little while, and this story's kind of already run its course a little bit, but there's still some of the feeling out there. There was a feeling in the late summertime, and I talked a lot about this on CNBC, where I spend a bunch of time as well, the technology, and in particular U.S. technology firms, had become a kind of, quote, and I use this word very loosely, safe haven in a world struggling with subprime. And the idea, of course, was that tech, unlike most of its counterparts across public equities in the U.S., had relatively minimal exposure, not just to subprime, but to credit in markets in general, and tech in particular is very export-centric. So when you have an industry that's seen as a growth industry that is has relatively little exposure to things like subprime and credit markets in particular, and is also highly export-centric, and in many aspects of what it does, in particular in sort of traditional tech, and by that I mean companies like, say, Cisco, Juniper, and others, isn't really that exposed to consumers. Well, those were all the hot buttons that we're worried about in the rest of the economy, consumers, credit, and the U.S. economy. So if you find a sector that looks like it has minimal exposure or less exposure, let's just say, to that group, no surprise, it's somewhat like somebody lit the afterburners. And so for a while in the late summer, that was the tech story, was that it was the safe haven from subprime. Now, that kind of fizzled a little bit in the fall, in particular whenever Cisco guided down and people felt kind of crummy about Cisco's results. And you know, that was a little bit overdone. And we're now coming back on a second go at it with, on the back in part, just recently of some decent results from some of the wireless companies, and in particular, even just overnight from Research in Motion. So it's back to the feeling again that, aha, text
back and say, well, it's interesting because in one way, I think that tech is definitely a bit shielded. But on the other hand, isn't everything all about the consumer when you kind of get right down to it? You know, the consumer something doesn't spend, nothing happens.
Yeah, something like 60-odd% of the U.S. GDP comes directly from consumer spending. So there's no avoiding, you know, the consumer's role in all of this. So, you know, at the end of the day, the consumer completely dries up. You aren't going to fill the gap with enterprise spending, and you certainly aren't going to fill the gap with China and East Asia spending through, you know, through higher exports and a lower dollar. So, you know, if the consumer really does tank, no sector's safe. There's no question.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's, and this is one of the things that sort of I like to sort of point out, people don't realize how, in particular, software is countercyclical, which is kind of perverse if you think about it. But what's happened is, if you say, for example, look at business investment in software since, I don't know, 1975, 1980, or the beginnings of the mainstream public part of that business, and map it against things like the U.S. sort of leading economic indicators in the U.S., you find out that there's actually a fairly consistent inverse relationship between the leading economic indicators in the U.S.
And
business investment in software.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. So, you know, in a sense, even if we really are weakening, and there's no question we are, there's ample reason to expect that software will do considerably better, subprime aside, than other sectors, if only because business is reluctant to cut software spending because there's a feeling it'll protect margins and boost productivity.
Well, the whole productivity thing, I mean, back, you know, when we, in the day, you know, you think back on 1998, and I was sitting there saying, wait a minute, we have this wonderful opportunity, you know, this B2B stuff, we have, you know, revolutionary levels of productivity enhancements, which is another code word for, well, we got some layoffs coming, you know, and,
right.
and the fact is now all of a sudden you kind of really play this all the way out. It's back to the issue back then it was of, well, who's going to be working? I mean, is it back to, you know, we're going to have iRobot, you know, who's going to be doing all the working, and then who's going to be paying for the goods that we need to buy? But then, you know, you kind of fast forward, and then I think that the biggest problem we've had, and tell me if you agree about this, next last 6 years has been this incredible spending boom, but it's all been based on this inertia of housing values, back to the stock market values. You wrote a post that talked about the next problem, which is going to be the commercial real estate market. And I think there was a little bit of banter back and forth with you and Barry Ritholtz. And here's the thing. I mean, the fact is that the American dream has now what turned into the world nightmare, right? Because as I say, and I've said 100 times, that builders are like puppy dogs, and puppy dogs will eat and eat and eat until they throw up. Builders will build until they just bankrupt themselves. And unfortunately, the watchdog for that industry was always the lenders, who would say, you know what, you're not getting it. You know, we're going to kind of cut down the lending. We're going to keep the margins and the loan to value. But what happened? Where did the wheels fall off of this whole thing?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of different answers. Answer number one is that, you know, the watchdogs were never as good at being watchdogs as we thought they were, or as we might like to imagine they were, and that should be no surprise, because if you're really that good at understanding the intricacies of financial instruments, you should, you know, get the hell out of government and start running a start making some real money, right?
The teachers that are teaching are not the ones that would do it.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, I mean, no surprise that the smartest people are on the other side of that particular trade.
Right.
So that's part of the answer. The other answer is, of course, is that the entire credit business has really changed to what my friends at PIMCO like to call, you know, Paul McCulley likes to call, the shadow banking system, the idea that really there is no there anymore. There is no center to the banking system. There's almost, in a sense, nothing to regulate, because everything is so quickly syndicated and moved around the world and, you know, in parceled out bits and pieces, that it's difficult, in a sense, to kind of, you know, really wrap your hands around anymore where the risk really sits. And that's part of it, which in some ways is a really good thing. Asset syndication has really helped broaden credit markets, which is great.
Yeah.
So there's that answer. And then there's this third answer, which is I've blogged about a number of times recently, but that if when faced with a bubble, or what even seems like a bubble, you've got two responses, or three, I guess. You could ignore it, which wouldn't make any sense. You can follow along and just, you know, revel in it, or you can sort of stand back and say, you know, I know this is going to burst. I don't know when, and I know it's going to be bad, but I don't want to be in it. what research shows pretty clearly is despite these things tend to end badly with fairly significant, you know, collapses in whether it's assets or equities, you're almost always better off, as horrible as this will sound to the orthodox fundamentalists out there, you're almost always better off just, you know, holding your nose and jumping into the bubble. You tend to, you will make more money, generally speaking. There's a great recent paper in the Journal of Finance on this. You'll make more money, generally speaking, playing along in the bubble. And what happens, of course, then is investors realize that there's the premium for getting to say, I told you so one day isn't very high. And so they play along in the bubble, and we just make things worse and worse each time, because each time more and more people learn that lesson, jump in the bubble, and the bubble gets bigger and faster, and the swings are more extreme. And mortgage markets, credit markets have been a classic example where no one wanted to be left out, even though everyone knew. The notion that no one knew this was a bubble or no one knew this would end badly is farcical. Everyone in the industry knew.
Yeah, I know. We were all talking about it for years. For 2 years, I was standing on the top of my chair saying, no real estate for my client, none. And everybody thought I was the biggest idiot in the world.
Yeah. The trouble, of course, is that not knowing when it will end and having, you know, fairly significant gains happening all the time. And this is a great, you know, Michael Lewis quote, is that, you know, you pay a huge premium for one day being able to say, I told you so.
Yeah, well, the fact of the matter is that it was very clear that the longer it went on, the harder it was going to fall. I mean, you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall, obviously.
Absolutely. The challenge, of course, is timing these things. And in the interim, standing back, in particular if you're a professional investor with institutions or individuals, standing there and saying, you know, trust me, one day this will end, as they watch, you know, 20% returns going down the pipe and they say, oh, well, you know, I sure hope you're right, but boy, oh, boy, I'm paying a high price.
Well, and the problem is, in the old days, the institutions wouldn't play along and clients would still stay with them. Nowadays, if the institutions don't play along, clients pull their money out. So institutions have no choice but to play along.
That's right. They have, you know, there's so much more liquidity and transparency, and everyone knows how people are doing on the other side of the fence, that, you know, it's very, very difficult when faced with that to stick with people who even are making an orthodox correct call. And you know, you end up, the money ends up swishing around from one side of the fish tank to the other.
Yeah. I have a friend who is a hedge fund manager. He runs a website, a blog. You may know him, Howard Lindzen, Wall
yep.
Strip, kind of funny stuff. You know, he has a theory that only a few years ago you would have said, come on, which is to buy in the positions that are at their highs. I mean, you know, in the quote-unquote old days, which is only 3 or 4 years ago maybe, you know, the things that were at their highs were clearly the ones that you'd be scraping out of a portfolio and investing in the contrary side into the positions, the dogs of the Dow style, or whatever it may be, that were very low and maybe going to move up. Now they're taking the position, or Howard is at least, that let's buy everything that's on its making all-time highs. Let's put more money into it.
Yeah, I mean,
it's been working.
I mean, and Howard's living testimony to it. He even built a little video program around it with his Wall Strip.
Yeah.
It's true, but you know what the other side is, and I think the way I would reinterpret what Howard's doing is recognizing that we've got a very narrow market where there's a few leading stocks and there's a bunch of also-rans who aren't going anywhere, and the market punishes the also-rans and it rewards the leaders, and that's a classic hallmark of a very narrow, thin market where only the leaders do well. As someone put it to me recently, essentially over the last 24 months, we've had the petro-Google market. That's all you had.
Right.
You had petroleum, you had Google, and that's how narrow. I mean, obviously it's an exaggeration, but that's how narrow the market got. And really what Howard's saying is the same thing. I mean, you were rewarded for buying those few stocks that had done well. The market had narrowed that much. There was that much capital chasing winners.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's been, I don't know. I find it to be, you know, from traditional classic training to be very frightening. So let me skip over to economics for a minute.
Sure.
Let's totally do away with any discussion of the current Fed and Bernanke and whatever they're doing or not doing, and that discussion of his being an academic, and forget all that. Let's talk about Greenspan for a second. There's been a lot of talk, you know, he was our savior for years. There's been a lot of talk about he is the reason for a lot of things that have happened, and he hasn't stepped up to the plate to really take a lot of the blame that's gone on. As a matter of fact, he's done a lot more of finger pointing and pushing the blame away. What's your comment on kind of looking back on the Greenspan regime of really his play in all of this?
Well, obviously he has. I mean, to the extent that we all believe, and I don't think there's anyone left who doesn't believe, but there's been a giant bubble in credit markets. I mean, he has obviously immense culpability, and I think that's fairly well established. That probably, at the very least, what happened was that he kept rates too low for too long. Do I believe that he was wrong in cutting rates as quickly as he did in the face of the dot-com collapse in 2000? There were a lot of people who believed that investors should have got their comeuppance at the time and rates at the very least should have been, you know, left alone. I don't necessarily buy that. I didn't buy the moral hazard argument at the time, still don't. But I do feel as if the rates did stay probably at least 150 to 200 basis points for a while lower than they should have been in the 2004 period. And that's if you look at, obviously, at home appreciation indices from the period was when things really began to accelerate and when some of the craziest loans began happening in terms of negative amortization and option arms and so on. And, you know, so you ask yourself the classic question, was that knowable at the time? So fine, we could say it was rates for, say, 150 or 200 basis points too low. Great, but was it possible for him to know? And, you know, there's a whole spate of models that were presented back at the recent Jackson Hole, well, this summer, I guess, not recent anymore, Jackson Hole Economic Symposium by the KC Fed, and the upshot of which was is that, yeah, it's absolutely knowable. It's absolutely knowable that rates were considerably lower than you would have, you know, knowing what GDP growth should be and knowing what a sort of trend was at the time for GDP growth, that we were lower than we should have been for longer than it should have been. So that, to me, was his great mistake, that will turn out to have been the problem. And the reason why is I think we've become too skittish about recessions. There's this feeling as if the Fed isn't just there to sort of facilitate a mode of exchange. It's there to actually act as insurance against recessions, which is a huge problem.
It's ridiculous. The fact is that if we go any further with the current situation, we're going to end up exactly back to what Greenspan was doing, was basically giving the pacifier to the baby till the baby was 22 years old if the baby was just not feeling well.
Right.
And the fact is that they're doing the same thing again, because whether or not we agree that the last rate cut of 25 basis points plus this dramatic increase, this open door policy for foreign countries to just provide liquidity for our... Actually, I have a question about that for you. I have a theory. We just saw that open door policy, right? That recent, it seems permanent now. I guess they made it permanent where if there's a requirement for liquidity without going through all the red tape, et cetera, now we got this liquidity, right? I mean,
right.
To sum it up.
Yep, that's right.
How about this for a theory? How about that's an anti-terrorist move? I know this is a little bit weird, but just bear with me for a second. how about this, that we're all of a sudden seeing Abu Dhabi and a variety of the Middle Eastern countries starting to, small amounts like $7.5 billion to bail out or to at least help Citibank. And, a lot of them saying, hey, you know what? It's a lot cheaper over here to buy things. We have so much money due to oil. How about the fact that we're trying to kind of step in front of them and make sure that the people that are bringing money into the U.S. are the people we want to be bringing money into the U.S.? In other words, for ownership purposes.
Oh, for sure. I mean, this is a big part of the problem. And, you know, even in the bank liquidity that's happening right now, that's outside of the credit auctions. Look at how quickly these transactions have come together at Merrill, Morgan Stanley, Citi, and elsewhere in terms of bringing in sovereign wealth funds and allowing them to take, you know, material pieces of key parts of the financial infrastructure. I mean, this is a really big deal. And as I think I commented yesterday or just recently on this, on CNBC, that, I mean, what people don't forget is we're heading into an election year, and in many ways this is much more troubling and has happened much faster than, you know, the old port scandal about who was going to control the ports. And, you know, whether you believe or not that it's appropriate for these sovereign wealth funds to have big stakes in the financial system, a little more time might be spent on thinking through the consequences.
I got to tell you something. If you really, I mean, like I said, not to get really way out there and strange on this whole terrorist or this kind of protectionism of U.S. interests, obviously, but I think it's much different than the Japanese buying Rockefeller Center at this point.
Oh, you know, absolutely. I mean, you think about the high-profile purchases that were made by Japan at the peak of their economic omnipotence, and it was, you know, Rockefeller Center, and it was Pebble Beach, and I think they lost money on both. Certainly they lost money on Pebble.
Right.
And it's very different whenever you start seeing these sovereign wealth funds buying struggling key pieces of the financial infrastructure. And then potentially, you know, being the lender of last resort should things get, you know, materially worse. And that's a very, very different scenario, and one that I think deserves a much broader hearing and hasn't been getting it.
Yeah, great. Two more quick questions, real quick. Hedge funds, the extreme use of leverage when they're doing 10 times, 8 times, 7 times multiples on municipal bonds and a variety of other quote-unquote safe instruments. What's your real quick opinion on the wisdom of that for the markets as a whole?
you know, it's one of these things where they have no choice, perversely enough. The returns on most of the most popular trades, by definition, because they are popular, have become so thin that the only way to earn returns is to lever yourself up to the ears. And that has immense consequences in terms of risk. And the linkages in markets are so direct that no surprise that whenever you're levered up and you go bust, you take a bunch of people with you. So short of actually regulating that, I think the only thing that we can do about it is force more transparency to understand the amount of liquidity or the amount of leverage being used and be very, very nervous when we see it happening. Because it
I was presented with it for a client. They came in and they were talking about 10 times deal on a municipal bond, short going short on borrow and long on it, and said there's never been an inverse on the mini bonds, and this can't have any problems. I said, oh, okay. All right, sounds good.
Yeah, and I mean, it's true right across the board. Now, long, short, neutral firms are having to put on that kind of leverage. They've gone from being able to earn reasonable returns at 1x and 2x leverage to 8 and 10x. I mean, it's truly remarkable.
Oh, yeah. All right, last thing, since your blog and what you're doing is all about saving the financial world, we discussed that, and making it a better place, let's talk about the mundane U.S. auto manufacturers. Here's my plan. Ready? We're going to get rid of the unions. We're going to stop producing crappy cars. We're going to stop giving away cars at no interest. We're going to get rid of the floor planning process that goes on. And we're going to a European kiosk style of ordering your car and then waiting for it. Bring in Michael Dell to show something about just-in-time processing and then retool the factories, and we're going to solve our problems. What do you think?
I love it. I think the auto industry requires very radical surgery at this point, and U.S. auto industry in particular. I mean, look at what's happening even in Europe with BMW today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, doing something to move them away from this ossified business of not having any ability to move, innovate, or change in the face of an industry that's changing in every way, ranging from financing to the cars themselves, it's a recipe for disaster without radical change.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, thanks for joining me today, and congratulations on winning the award from our site to yours, the best World of Finance blog. And I appreciate you coming on, sharing your wisdom, and solving all these issues. And we look forward to reading. How can everybody get in touch with you? What's the best place for them to go?
Just go straight to the blog. I have there's a contact link on the site at paul.kudrowski.com, and they can go straight there and send me a note.
All right, great. And we'll also put the link and some information about the site for our listeners so they can get to that. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, that's about it. When we get back next week, we got some really great things. I'm going to tell you about the MoneyCast Network, and I'm going to tell you about some of the exciting things we have planned in store for you. Don't forget to visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com and pick up your copy of my book. I'd appreciate it. I think you'll learn a lot, especially in these rocky markets. Go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, our site, and, of course, that special offer where you can pick up a copy and then leave a review on Amazon. I'll send you a free copy of our audiobook. Until next time, have a good week. Be safe. It's rough out there right now. This is Andrew Horowitz from The Disciplined Investor Podcast, signing off and saying have a great week. See you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.